Coming up is an interview with Dominique Péchard, who is the president of the Commission.
Ligue des droits et libertés.
Les Ligue des droits et libertés. Okay. We are at the People's Commission, Whose Security, Our Security panel and workshops being held in Montreal this weekend in early February. And right now we're speaking with Dominique Péchard, the president of the Ligue des droits et libertés here in Montreal. Hello, Mr. Péchard.
Hello.
I'm curious to know, Mr. Péchard, how did you become interested in this type of activism against all these new security protocols in Canada?
Well, in fact, I became interested at the Summit of the Americas in 2001.
Yeah.
Now, no.
No.
Okay. We'll start and we'll see how much we can get done again. I'm really sorry. Very much so. Okay. We are at the People's Commission. Panel discussions and workshops on titled Whose Security, Our Security, being held this weekend in early February in Montreal. We are speaking with Danielle Péchard, who is the president of the Ligue des droits et libertés here in Quebec. Bonjour, Monsieur Péchard.
Hello.
Firstly, Mr. Péchard, I'd like to know how you became interested in the activism against security.
Well, in fact, I became interested slightly before 9/11 around the Summit of the Americas in Quebec, when the police announced the measures that were bound to stifle the rights of demonstrators. So the League organized a watch committee to denounce and surveil the police activity and defend the rights of demonstrators. So I got involved in that. And then soon after that, 9/11 came along with all the measures, anti-liberties measures and rights and measures against the rights of citizens. And so I continued being active in the League in this context.
You're participating here today in a panel discussion on terrorist watch lists as a mechanism of political and social control. And with respect to those watch lists, I'm curious to know, when did these watch lists first appear and why in Canada?
Well, they appeared first in the United States right after 9/11. Before 9/11, the wanted terrorists on the American list were no more than a dozen or two dozen, something like that. And after 9/11, the whole thing went out of exploded when the United States set up a system whereby anybody who had a profile which was considered a risk to national security, independently of whether the person had done anything or not, or was about to do anything, were put on lists. So all the agencies of the United States started putting people on lists based on risk assessment. And the fact is now there's about a million people on the American terrorist watch list.
How does the existence of these lists affect the Canadian citizenry at large?
Well, it affects Canadian citizens because people are put on these lists without knowing they're put on the list, without knowing what agency put them on the list, and without knowing why they were put on the list. So we have the situation where Canadians have found themselves blocked at the border or else prevented from boarding a plane because they were told they were on the list. And they don't know why, who put them there, and there's no effective redress mechanism.
Without naming any names, do you know anybody to whom this has happened in particular?
Well, there are several Canadians who came forth a monitoring group, a monitoring activity of problems at the borders, and it's called Traveler's Watch List. You can find it on the internet, and there are many case histories related there of ordinary Canadians being prevented from boarding a plane, either often because simply they had the same name as somebody who was on the watch list.
Travelerswatchlist.com, something like that?
Yeah. Travelers Watch List. Type that in Google and you'll find more information on those on problems which are met by Canadians at the border.
So when people arrive at the border and they're finding themselves caught up in this situation of being on some kind of a list, are they told as to how or why they ended up on the list at that point in time?
No, because that's Kafkaesque. It's like the security certificates. I mean, for national security reasons, you don't know why you've been put on the list. So, and you don't know who's put you on the list. And especially if you're Canadian and the Americans have put you on the list, then you have no access to redress, because Canadians who have been prevented from boarding a plane because of an American list, but if they've been prevented from boarding a plane in Canada, then when they address the American authorities, they say, well, it's not our problem because it hasn't occurred on that American territory. So even though it's an American list, you're blocked in the Canadian airport, and then they say, well, it's not our problem. So you're pretty well stifled, and you can't do much about it.
Can't do much about it. Are there precautions we can take in our lives on a daily basis to stay off of lists?
Not really, because, for example, in 2006, the American network CBS got a hold of the American list, and there were 45,000 names at that time on the list, the no-fly list, and they found among the names a very ordinary name, R. Smith, and then they convened in their studios all the R. Smiths they could find in the area, and they all had problems boarding the plane because of their name corresponded to somebody on the list. So you could be a Canadian R. Smith and have problems. And when Canadians have addressed the authorities, asked what to do, often they've got the answer, well, change your name.
Change your name. That is Kafkaesque. Well, thank you very much, Danielle.
Dominic Péchard.
Excuse me.
It's okay.
Thank you very much, Dominic.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
We've been speaking with Dominic Péchard, president of the Ligue des Droits et Libertés here in Quebec, and also presenter at the People's Commission, Who Security, Our Security panel discussion on terrorist watch lists as a mechanism of social and political control. My name is Haroun Blake.
Thank you, merci beaucoup. Je t'en prie. Okay. All right. You helped me so much. This is now flashing again.
Okay, now coming up, panel discussion on terrorist watch lists as a mechanism of political and social control. February 6, 2011, sound recordist Haroun Blake.
Qui va le faire. Donc, tout le monde qui ne comprend pas le français ou ne comprend pas l'anglais, excusez-moi, allez vous asseoir à côté de Rémi. Okay. Est-ce qu'il y en a? Est-ce que vous pouvez vous lever la main? Is there anyone here who needs the translation towards English from French? Two people? Okay, if you don't mind going and sitting towards the back corner, Ali, who's standing there, is going to translate into English. C'est beau. Donc, il y a des gens ici, des médias indépendants et communautaires qui vont filmer, qui vont enregistrer. Donc, s'il y a quelqu'un ou quelques-uns ici qui préfèrent ne pas être filmé ou ne pas être enregistré, est-ce que vous pouvez juste aller voir Marie qui est au coin et puis indiquer que vous ne voulez pas être filmé ou enregistré et puis on va s'assurer que ça ne se fait pas. So there are independent and and community media people here who are filming and recording. So if anybody is uncomfortable or would prefer not to be filmed or recorded, just step over and see Mary, who's in the corner. So, welcome everybody. Thank you for coming. I'm just going to give a very brief introduction in English and then pass the microphone to the participants. The title of this panel, the theme of this panel is blacklisting and blacklists. And we're going to try to take a slightly different look at that phenomenon today. There are many current and historical examples of states using blacklists to control or repress members of their populations. The famous U.S. blacklists of the McCarthy era and, you know, anti-communist blacklists, no-fly lists across the world, Canada's lists of terrorist entities, the United Nations 1267 list, the European Union's terrorist list, the United States terrorist watch list, which now has tens of thousands of people on it, and on and on. These are lists that grow and rarely shrink. They're lists that people find themselves on. Seemingly, it's quite easy to get on and virtually impossible to get off. And across all of these different examples of these various blacklists that are in existence, you know, there's a few common themes. In almost all cases, the listing processes are highly politicized. It's the executive branches of government who decide who is on and who is off, and there's very little accountability or transparency in the processes. And of course, there are some well-known and some widely publicized examples of, you know, people who have found themselves on these lists and the problems that they've had, or groups that have been listed and the repercussions of that. And there has been a fairly significant amount of public discussion and discourse about these lists. But most of that attention has been focused on the legalities of the various listing mechanisms, or the justification or lack thereof for a particular person or organization being on one of the lists. And without, you know, belittling those questions, those are important questions, what we're hoping to do during the panel now and the workshop that's going to follow later this afternoon is to put a different focus on these issues and to look and to think more carefully about the political context of listing as a phenomenon, but also of particular listings that happen, and also to look at the effects of various listings on individuals, on families, on communities, and especially on the social and political movements that are connected to the listed individuals and groups. So, you know, for example, what happens to the Tamil community and the movement for Tamil sovereignty or for rights for Tamils in Sri Lanka when the LTT is put on the list? What happens to the union movement or, you know, leftist movements in general in Colombia when the FARC is put on the list? What happens to somebody's family and friends when they find themselves on a terrorist watch list? What happens to that person? So we're looking, you know, at the lists rather than from sort of a legalistic perspective, but trying to see them as part of the state's arsenal of mechanisms of social control and political repression, and to think about the listings as another channel through which modern states consolidate their monopolies on the legitimate use of violence and power. So to get things started this morning, we're going to hear from Dominique Péchard, who's going to speak to us briefly about the various lists, or not all of them, but some of the more important lists that exist in Canada, and give us a little explanation of how they function. And then we're going to pass it over to Issam El-Yamani on my left, who has been fighting his deportation for almost 20 years now because of connection to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which is a listed entity in Canada now. And then we're going to show a video. It's a 40-minute video where we have five people being interviewed who are talking about the effects of the listing on themselves and their social networks and the political movements that they were part of. And I'll come back and I'll introduce those people before we start the video. So, Dominique Péchard est président de la Ligue des droits et libertés. Il a donné de nombreuses conférences au Québec sur des questions liées à la prolifération des mécanismes de contrôle et de surveillance. Puis il a fondé et présidé le colloque « On nous fiche, nous nous en fichons pas » qui s'est déroulé à Montréal en janvier 2010. Il est aussi membre du comité coordinateur du groupe de surveillance internationale des libertés civiles. And just to pass it to Dominique, I just want to say we're going to take questions at the end after we've shown the video. Some of the participants in the video are here too. So if you have questions for Dominique, please save them and we'll take them all at the end.
Dominique. Bon, alors bonjour. Merci de m'avoir invité pour parler d'un sujet, des aspects les plus inquiétants de l'atteinte aux libertés depuis les attentats du 11 septembre 2001. C'est-à-dire la prolifération de listes de surveillance et de listes dites antiterroristes de toutes sortes. Ces listes-là ont toutes des caractéristiques en commun. Premièrement, elles sont élaborées en secret, de façon arbitraire, le plus souvent sur la recommandation de services policiers et des agences de renseignement, première chose. Deuxième chose, il n'y a pas de processus de révision judiciaire. Et les personnes qui sont sur ces listes n'ont pas recours à des véritables mécanismes d'appel par rapport à le fait qu'elles sont sur la liste. Alors, évidemment, ceci est une violation fondamentale des libertés. Les différentes listes les principales, je ne peux pas les faire toutes, mais premièrement, il y en a une qui a été mise en place en vertu de la loi antiterroriste canadienne, qui a été adoptée en décembre 2001. Et cette loi donne au cabinet le pouvoir d'inscrire une entité considérée terroriste sur simple recommandation du ministre de la Sécurité publique. Alors, il suffit d'avoir des motifs raisonnables de croire que l'entité s'est liée ou a tenté de se livrer à une activité terroriste ou à participer ou faciliter, ou que quelqu'un agit au nom d'une entité sous sa direction ou en collaboration. Et il faut noter que les entités visées sont inscrites sur la base de la définition très vague du terrorisme dans la loi antiterroriste, qui fait qu'une personne peut avoir facilité une activité terroriste sans même le savoir. Autrement dit, vous pouvez avoir posé un geste qui, vous n'avez pas besoin de savoir sciemment que vous avez collaboré à aider une entité terroriste pour être accusé d'avoir facilité une activité terroriste. Maintenant, l'inscription d'une entité sur la liste ne veut pas dire nécessairement qu'elle a commis un crime, mais ça a des conséquences très graves sur l'entité. D'après la loi, ses biens peuvent être saisis, bloqués, confisqués. Les institutions financières ont l'obligation de soumettre des rapports concernant les avoirs d'une entité et d'empêcher l'entité d'accéder à ses avoirs. Alors, ça a des conséquences. Par exemple, tout organisme de charité ou d'aide humanitaire peut être associé directement ou indirectement à une entité et voir son statut de charité révoqué ou ses avoirs confisqués. Alors, ici, on peut penser, par exemple, à des situations comme au Liban ou la bande de Gaza. Il y a présentement une quarantaine d'entités sur la liste canadienne, comme les FARC en Colombie, mais aussi le Hezbollah au Liban ou le Hamas en Palestine. Or, comme c'est le Hamas et aussi le pouvoir politique élu en Palestine et le Hezbollah est un parti politique reconnu au Liban, il est très difficile évidemment de travailler dans ces pays-là sans avoir un contact quelconque avec ces organisations-là. Donc, on peut être associé au terrorisme par ce biais-là. D'ailleurs, M. Galloway, que le gouvernement canadien a tenté d'empêcher de venir au Canada, il y a à peu près un an, ça a été sur la base qu'il avait soi-disant collaboré avec le Hamas. Bon, alors, et cet effet-là peut être rétroactif. Je vais donner un exemple qui a eu lieu en 2006. Monsieur Khalil, qui est d'origine libanaise, était sur un vol d'Air Transat de Toronto vers le Mexique. C'était un vol direct, donc il n'y avait pas d'escale aux États-Unis. Quand l'avion s'est trouvé au-dessus du territoire des États-Unis, l'avion a été a été suivi par des avions de chasse de l'armée américaine à travers tout le territoire des États-Unis, de la frontière canadienne à la frontière du Mexique, parce que M. Khalil était à bord de l'avion. Et arrivé au Mexique, il a été arrêté. Sa femme et ses enfants, c'est un voyage familial, ont été mis sur un avion de retour pour le Canada. Et lui a dû revenir au Canada sur un vol privé escorté par des agents de la GRC. Or, M. Khalil était un militant dans les années 90. Il militait politiquement dans l'Hezbollah. Il l'avait déclaré quand il était venu au Canada. Et ça n'avait jamais posé de problème jusque-là. Mais dorénavant, simplement à cause de cette activité-là, M. Khalil est une personne sur des listes et ne peut plus voyager. Et plus récemment, ça a lieu présentement, ça c'est une personne qui habite à Vancouver, M. José Figueroa, qui est un réfugié, qui est une personne qui a demandé le statut de réfugié au Canada, qui a 3 enfants nés au Canada, et fait face à des tentatives de déportation du Canada parce qu'il a été militant du Front Farabundo Martí de Libération quand il était au Salvador. Pourtant, le Front Farabundo Martí n'est pas sur la liste des entités terroristes et c'est même le gouvernement élu du Salvador présentement. Et le ministre d'État aux affaires étrangères, Peter Kent, est même allé à l'investiture du président Funes du Front Farabundo Martí en juin 2009. Donc, on voit l'arbitraire qu'il y a dans toutes ces mesures-là. Évidemment, comme c'était mentionné dans la présentation, dans certains pays, comme en Amérique latine, la dissidence est criminalisée et associée au terrorisme. Les lois antiterroristes ont été invoquées au Pérou contre des militants qui s'opposaient à un projet minier. Donc, ces militants-là peuvent se retrouver sur des listes de terrorisme international. La liste américaine dressée par le Terrorism Screening Center aux États-Unis avait environ 1,1 million de noms en 2008 et on évalue qu'à peu près 25 000 noms sont ajoutés chaque mois. Ces noms-là sont ajoutés par pas moins de 16 agences américaines qui relèvent du Homeland Security. Les gens sont ajoutés de façon arbitraire, sans procédure judiciaire, selon des critères qui sont propres aux agences et sans mécanisme de coordination entre les agences. Les personnes qui sont sur ces listes n'en sont pas informées et elles peuvent le découvrir au moment d'une interdiction de vol et elles ne peuvent pas savoir quelle agence les a inscrites ni les motifs de la décision. Et très difficile et peu de personnes ont réussi à cette date à faire rayer leur nom des listes. Il y a évidemment aussi la liste des Nations Unies, la fameuse liste 1267, l'infâme liste 1267 des talibans et Al-Qaïda. Les gens peuvent être mis sur ces listes par les membres du Conseil de sécurité, les 15 membres à l'unanimité. Il n'y a aucune procédure judiciaire, mais les noms sont rendus publics. Il faut aller sur le site du Conseil de sécurité et avoir la liste des personnes. La preuve, entre guillemets, derrière les allégations pour mettre une personne sur la liste sont secrètes. Le Conseil peut rayer des noms, mais ça prend le consentement unanime. Si un membre du Conseil s'y oppose, le nom reste sur la liste. Il y a environ présentement 400 individus et 111 entités ou organisations sur la liste et ça impose une interdiction de vol et un gel des avoirs des individus et des organisations. Bon, il y a présentement un cas que vous connaissez sans doute, un Canadien sur la liste, Aboustian Abdelrazik. Il a été rapatrié par le gouvernement canadien sur ordre de la Cour. Mais en vertu de la loi canadienne, il est interdit à quiconque de lui offrir une aide matérielle, peu importe qu'il s'agisse de salaire, de prêts, de vêtements ou même d'assurance maladie. Le gouvernement canadien refuse toujours de lui venir en aide et en lui disant de s'adresser lui-même au conseil. Or, personne n'a encore été rayé de cette liste sans intervention de son gouvernement. Alors, d'ici là, il ne peut pas blanchir sa réputation et tous ceux qui l'ont appuyé ou continuent de lui venir en aide sont susceptibles d'être accusés d'association au terrorisme. La liste a été condamnée par plusieurs instances au niveau international. L'Assemblée parlementaire du Conseil de l'Europe a voté une résolution en janvier 2008 critiquant le régime 1267 comme violant les principes fondamentaux des droits humains et la règle de droit. En mars 2010, la Suisse a aussi désapprouvé du régime 1267 et le Parlement suisse a adopté une résolution à l'effet que le gouvernement suisse allait informer les Nations unies, le Conseil de sécurité, que le gouvernement suisse n'appliquerait pas les sanctions du régime 1267 contre des individus qui n'auront pas été déférés à la justice, donc n'auront pas subi un procès et trouvé coupable. Et finalement, en janvier 2010, la Cour suprême de Royaume-Uni, d'Angleterre, a éliminé la législation interne en Angleterre, comme il y en a une au Canada qu'on veut faire rayer, la législation qui est en Angleterre en vertu du régime 1267. Et évidemment, il y a le commentaire du juge Zinn qui a ordonné le rapatriement d'Aboustiane Abdelrazik à l'effet que ce régime est un déni des principes de droit les plus élémentaires et était tenable en matière de droits humains international. Alors, la liste du 67 est certainement une liste qu'il faut continuer de travailler au Canada et internationalement à éliminer. Il y a aussi les listes d'interdiction de vol. Ce sont les listes qui, en fait, dans la pratique, affectent le plus grand nombre de personnes dans la vie quotidienne. Aux États-Unis, la liste avait 45 000 noms en octobre 2006. Elles sont utilisées par les compagnies canadiennes, même pour les vols internes. Et il est très difficile de se faire retirer d'une telle liste. Et le fait d'être innocenté par des instances judiciaires ne vous permet pas d'être retiré de la liste. Le cas le plus connu est Maher Arar, qui a une commission d'enquête qui l'a blanchi complètement des allégations contre lui, mais néanmoins, il continue d'être sur la liste d'interdiction de vol des États-Unis. Il y a le cas d'Adil Sharkawi, et il y a des cas comme M. Al-Maki et Nureddin. M. Al-Maki était interdit de faire un vol interne au Canada à cause de ça. Le Canada a sa propre liste d'interdiction de vol qui a été établie en juin 2007. Vous êtes inscrit sur cette liste sur recommandation de deux officiers supérieurs du GRC et du SCRS. Le mécanisme d'examen se fait à huis clos. Vous ne connaissez pas les raisons pour lesquelles vous êtes sur la liste. Le mécanisme d'appel, il y a une personne qui est nommée pour faire une révision si je vous en appelez d'être sur cette liste, mais c'est à huis clos. Alors, ça ressemble beaucoup au certificat de sécurité. Il y a présentement un cas devant les tribunaux qui conteste son nom sur la liste et la constitutionnalité de la dite liste canadienne. Mais le plus inquiétant, c'est le régime qui est en train d'être mis en place présentement de surveillance des voyageurs, qui s'appelle en programme américain Secure Flight. En vertu de ce programme-là, non seulement les compagnies aériennes ne feront pas que manière de parler, vérifier avant que si votre nom correspond à une liste qu'elles ont en main, que ce soit une liste américaine ou canadienne, mais toutes les informations sur les passagers devront être transmises aux autorités américaines avant le départ du vol, même pour les vols qui ne font que survoler les États-Unis. Et c'est Homeland Security qui enverra aux compagnies aériennes une autorisation de laisser monter les passagers à bord. Donc, ça veut dire que les autorités américaines auront un contrôle total sur qui peut voler la plupart des vols internationaux du Canada, parce qu'à peu près tous les vols internationaux vers l'Amérique latine survolent les États-Unis et la grande majorité des vols vers l'Europe. Donc, on va se retrouver avec des situations comme, par exemple, M. Hernando Calvo Ospina, qui est un journaliste du Monde diplomatique. Il était en vol de Paris vers le Mexique pour faire un reportage sur le Nicaragua. Son vol allait survoler les États-Unis. Les autorités américaines ont ordonné que l'avion soit détourné parce qu'ils ne voulaient pas avoir M. Ospina sous son territoire. L'avion allait faire escale en Martinique. Alors, Or, pourtant, c'était assez évident que M. Calvo Ospina ne représentait aucun risque pour la menace, pour le transport aérien ou pour les États-Unis. Donc, on voit comment de telles mesures vont pouvoir empêcher des gens qui, pour des raisons politiques, de voyager, des raisons qui n'ont rien à voir avec le terrorisme, comme c'était mentionné dans la présentation. Donc, on peut penser à des militants d'Amérique latine qui sont étiquetés comme terroristes parce qu'ils sont des opposants et qui se retrouvent donc interdits, par exemple, de faire un voyage au Canada. Pour, par exemple, si on invitait des militants environnementaux ou syndicaux d'un pays comme le Pérou ou la Colombie, bien, les États-Unis pourraient les empêcher de venir au Canada. Ça pose aussi une menace pour des voyageurs canadiens qui voyageraient vers le Moyen-Orient, parce que les États-Unis pourraient, sachant, ayant l'identité des passagers, pourraient très bien laisser quelqu'un d'origine syrienne voyager partir pour la Syrie ou le Moyen-Orient, mais aviser les autorités pour qu'il y ait une détention dans le pays en question et qu'il y ait une détention et torture, comme ça a eu lieu déjà pour des citoyens canadiens. Donc, c'est une menace, non seulement une violation de droit, mais une menace sérieuse pour un certain nombre de personnes. Alors, vous voyez comment toutes ces listes sont une atteinte aux libertés et elles reposent sur une définition du terrorisme qui a été étirée pour englober, en fait, la dissidence, comme ça a été dit dans la présentation. Aux États-Unis, le cas le plus grotesque, c'est le cas qui a été mis en lumière par l'American Civil Liberties Union, qui a mis la main sur un manuel d'introduction du Pentagone. C'est un cours d'introduction sur « homegrown terrorism », le terrorisme domestique. C'est pas une très bonne traduction, mais je dis pas mieux que ça. Et la première question, c'est, d'après vous, c'est un test de connaissance de base, d'introduction au cours, quel est l'élément suivant, quelle action suivante constitue un acte de terrorisme homegrown ou de bas niveau? Et parmi les quatre choix, il y a participer à une manifestation. Et c'est ça la bonne réponse. Les autres choix, c'est poser une bombe et des choses comme ça. Mais, donc, dans le manuel du Pentagone, participer à une manifestation est déjà considéré comme un acte de terrorisme. Alors, voilà, si vous avez des questions, bien, on pourra élaborer un peu après la présentation du film. Vous pourrez poser, je le dis en passant, vous pourrez poser vos questions en anglais ou en espagnol. Là, c'est pas de problème, je répondrai dans la langue qui convient. Merci.
Merci beaucoup, Dominique.
We're now going to hear from Issam Al-Yamani. Issam is a Palestinian refugee, an activist, and a writer who's been in Canada since 1985. Two security certificates were issued against him in the 1990s, both of which were quashed by the federal court. Nevertheless, in 2005, he was deemed inadmissible to Canada as a past member of the PFLP, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which was listed as a terrorist organization in Canada in 2003. A deportation order was issued against Mr. Al-Yamani in 2006.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Since I don't speak French and many of you don't speak English, so I'll speak in Arabic. What about that? Okay, I don't know when or where to start, but I'll quote Stephen Harper. Any attack on Israel is considered an attack on Canada. Canada and Israel shares a common values. Any criticism of Israel is a hidden anti-Semitic science that explains the position of the Canadian government against Palestinian organizations, especially those who are committed to liberate Palestine from Israeli occupation. I'll make a brief history about the PFLP, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which was founded in 1967 after the 1967 war. It's a leftist Marxist organization was aligned with the Soviet bloc, and that made it a target by Western forces, Canada, the United States, and many European countries during the Cold War to be listed as a terrorist organization. The PFLP was involved in hijacking airplanes, and in 1972, the same organization criticized itself for that, for these kinds of operations, and decided not to commit any hijacking any more. The PFLP is a multifaceted organization. Palestinians in the refugee camps, though you don't have any government, so Palestinian organizations take care of the everyday needs of the Palestinian people in the refugee camps. They build daycares, night school, clinics, etc., etc., and they provide social services to the refugees in the camps. And there is around 11 Palestinian organizations in the camps. In Canada, if you want to participate in a political movement, you join maybe the Liberal Party, the Conservative Party, the NDP, Parti Québécois, the Communist Party, the Socialist, Internationalist, you name it. And the refugee camps and in Palestine, we joined the PFLP, we joined Fatah, we joined the PFLP, and all of them are considered, according to us, according to our perception, according to our circumstances, they all of them are national liberation movements whom want to liberate their country from the occupation, Israeli Zionist colonial occupation. By the way, the PFLP listed Canada in the state-sponsored terrorism before Canada lists the PFLP. Because in the strategy of the PFLP, Western capitalists who supports Israel are considered state-sponsored terrorism. And any country that supports occupation should be listed by national liberation movements. So maybe Canada is revenging from the PFLP by listing the PFLP in this list. Anyhow, when I came to Canada in 1985, I do remember exactly the officer in the embassy in Lebanon, Beirut. He asked me, "Mr. Yamani, are you a member of the PLO?" I said, "No, the PLO doesn't, it's a coalition of organizations. I'm not a member of the PLO as such." He asked me, "Do you know how to use arms?" I said, "You know, we are in Lebanon. Everyone has at least two or three machine guns. So I know how to use arms. I'm living in Lebanon and I'm living in the refugee camps." And he said, "You are not a member of any terrorist organization." I said, "No, I'm not a member of a terrorist organization. I'm a Palestinian who's fighting to be free." And anyway, they grant me the landed immigrant, and I came to Canada in 1985. And when I was asked by CC's officers, let's go back to the PFLP. I don't want to. So in 1986. The Canadian 1987, when the Intifada started in Palestine, the first Intifada started, the Canadian government started talking and visiting the PFLP offices in Damascus to know about their own perspective of what's going on in the occupied territories and what might happen during the Intifada. And at that point, I used to receive copies of the minutes of the meeting since I was in Canada. So I thought it's good that Canada is open now to have a dialogue with the Palestinian National Liberation Movements. And the PFLP was not listed in any list at that point. There wasn't a list, as a matter of fact, because in 1986 it started, the Soviet Union started to deteriorate and it collapsed in the early 90s, and the Islamic movement started being more active, and the Palestinian left start to move backward, if I may say. There was a new enemy, the Islamist, and the leftist became part of something like softy powers. In 1991, when Madrid started, the PFLP was against Madrid and the Oslo process, and that triggers the Canadian government to take a position against the PFLP. And my activities in Canada start to be considered as subversive activities against a democratic country, which is Israel. I applied for my citizenship in 1988, and after 18 months I didn't receive any response. When I asked, they told me that we are waiting for clearance from CSIS. So I called CSIS. I told them, I was told that my application is in your department and I want to know why the delay. They say, okay, call us in 3 months. So I called in 3 months, there was no answer, so I made a complaint against CSIS to the Security Intelligence Review Committee. I didn't want to wait, because I was never questioned by CSIS, but I recognized that I'm under surveillance, and that's why they are not questioning me and they are not interviewing me. So we went to the Security Intelligence Review Committee to discuss this complaint, and the judge, the lawyer of the Security Intelligence Review Committee was Simon Noel, and he is the same judge who is doing the security certificate issues these days in the federal court. So they found that I was a member of the PFLP, and they issued a security certificate and a deportation order against me in 1993. I appealed that decision, and I won based on freedom of association, because the PFLP is a multifaceted organization and I was a member of the PFLP. I severed ties with the PFLP in 1991, official ties, and I expressed, and until this time I expressed that I was, and I am very proud of every single day, hour, minute I was a member of the PFLP and part of the Palestinian National Liberation Movement, and I will not give up that right. So, and the judge asked the Security Intelligence Review Committee if they have a different issue other than a previous membership with the PFLP. At that particular time, the immigration was in the process, because of my case, because I was a member, and the subsection of the Immigration Act used to say, persons who are. So the immigration and CSIS, they didn't have a case. So they added a subsection to the Immigration Act that reads, persons who are or were members of a certain category, and by that clause they can get anyone, even he, if he was a member of any organization 40 or 60 or 50 or 10 years ago. So the judge asked the government, the Security Intelligence Review Committee to see if there is any issue other than membership, previous membership. So they came after another hearing. He quashed the security certificate and the deportation order, and there was another hearing with CERC where they found that I'm a subversive person. My activities are subversive against a government, democratic government, which is friend to Canada, something like that, which is Israel. And I appealed, and another security certificate was issued against me, and I appealed the second security certificate, and I won because the judge said, based on an expert evidence, Rig Whitaker, Professor Rig Whitaker. Subversive, if you are a subversive, you should be a citizen of that state. And since I'm not an Israeli citizen, I cannot be subversive. So it was quashed, and the judge asked CERC, if you have another issues, you can bring them to the court. So CSIS and CERC decided not to appeal, and I called immigration. I told them, look, guys, citizenship. In 1988, I applied for my citizenship, and I think the photos I gave you, it's now old. It's 1999. Do you need different pictures for the citizenship card? They said, no, we will use the same photos. We'll use the same photos. And to my surprise and my lawyer's surprise, I received a letter to appear before the IRB, Immigration Refugee Board, for a deportation hearing. So why I won the cases, two security certificates were quashed, the two deportation orders were canceled. What's the accusation now? They accused me of being a member of the PFLP, that I was a member of the PFLP. This subsection, when that they didn't use during the CERC's hearings, they used it, the immigration used it, after I won the two cases, and after they promised that they will not try me under this new law. So I appealed the decision, and we consider that this process is abusive process, and the question became personal between Al Yamani and the CIC and CSIS and the CMP. And I lost the case because the law is straightforward. Members who are or were, and I admit that I was. The irony here, my ex-wife, she was a Canadian citizen, and she used to tease me that I can be a member of the PFLP. You cannot be a member of the PFLP because you are a landed immigrant. My brother, who is a refugee claimant, can be put in prison because he is a member of the PFLP. And I'm speaking for Hassan. He had the security certificate. He was in prison because he was a refugee. And I was a landed immigrant. They couldn't put me in prison. But if I'm a citizen, I can be a member of the PFLP at that point, and no one can tell me. And that leads us to the comment the first speaker said that there is a certain rules apply differently to different people. A Canadian citizen can be a member of the PFLP and a Palestinian cannot. I don't understand the logic. It's they really appreciate the rights of Canadians under the Charter. So under this process, we lost our case, and I applied under ministerial relief, and I submitted to the Minister Stockwell Day. I submitted evidence that I'm a good person, and I'm a good person. I was a member of the PFLP. I'm committed to the Palestinian cause, and I had letters from different organizations and professors and unions to that distinct to saying that I'm a good person. And immigration also submitted their response to Stockwell Day. So he denied me based on the CIC's submissions. He denied me the right to stay in Canada. And to be honest with you, staying in Canada, it wasn't, and it's not the issue for me. I can go to Lebanon, live easily there, and be happy. But I wanted to fight this issue because I don't want the Canadian security services to win this case and use it against my community and other immigrants. And we have to fight for our rights. This is the main issue. So I appealed against Stockwell Day, and I won because I requested written reasons from him why he ignored my submission and based on what reason, especially the CSIS and the CIC wrote in their submission that we don't have any evidence. For the last 14 years, we don't have any evidence that Assam Yamani is a member or affiliated with the PFLP. But if Assam Yamani became a Canadian citizen, he might join the PFLP and go to commit acts of violence against Israel. For the issue here, the national security issue, has nothing to do with Canada. It has to do with the Israeli government, in my case, with the Indian or Sri Lankan government, in other cases. And if we want, if Canada wants to fight terrorism, it should define it properly, and it should define what is national liberation movements. You cannot fight, Canada cannot fight terrorism without defining national liberation movement and without defining what do we mean by national security. If I want to define national security, I'll say it's any external or domestic influence that it might danger the lives or the security of the majority of the Canadian people or Canada. And in this case, I think Mr. Harper is a national threat, security threat to the Canadian public. Why? Because he supports occupation. As simple as that. And once you support occupation, you are subjected, the Canadian public or the Canadian persons or the Canadian citizens who travel abroad, to be revenged against. People might react against the Canadian people. And when Mossad, the Israeli agents, used Canadian passport to commit assassination against Palestinian leaders, they are endangering the Canadian public, and they should be considered a national threat and security. It's a national threat to the Canadian public. when Mr. Harbar says that we share the same values with Israel. I don't know. I don't understand how come you share the same values of an occupier, unless you admit that Canada is a colonial force, and in that issue you have the same values, Palestinian versus the native people. Anyhow, I don't have much time, but I'm willing to answer all your questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Isam. So we're going to screen a video. The video is 40 minutes long. It's obviously going to be on this screen, so if you can't see from where you are, you might want to move.
Panel discussion on terrorist watch list as a use of mechanism and mechanism of political and social control. End part one for video presentation.
I'm just going to give a brief introduction for the five people who you see in the video. Some of them are here, and they will be available to answer your questions afterwards. So in no particular order, the people who you will see in this video, the first one, Abu Sufyan Abdurazak, is a name that probably a lot of people know. He was arrested while on a visit to the Sudan in 2003. The federal court later found that his arrest probably took place at the request of CSIS, the Canadian Security Intelligence Service. He was detained and tortured in the Sudan. While he was detained in the Sudan, he was questioned by agents from CSIS. After he was released from prison, he was blocked from returning to Montreal, in part through the Canadian government's strategic use of the UN blacklist, the 1267 list that Dominique was speaking about. The federal court finally forced the Canadian government to repatriate him. Now that he's back in Montreal, he continues his campaign to have his name removed from the UN 1267 blacklist, which prevents him from traveling internationally and imposes an asset freeze on him. Another person who you'll see in the video is Suleiman Govin, who's here with us today. Suleiman is a Toronto-based editor of Yeni Hayat, an online news source. He's a Kurdish refugee from Turkey, who came to Canada in 1991 and was recognized as a refugee in 1993. CSIS blackmailed him to become a community informant in exchange for papers. When he refused, they claimed that he was a member of the PKK, a Kurdish National Liberation Movement, which they consider to be a terrorist organization. Suleiman did not receive his permanent residence until 2006, after a protracted legal struggle. We're also going to hear from Amparo Torres, who was born in Colombia, where she was a union leader and co-founder of the left-wing Umbrella, a non-factionalist party, the Union Patriotica. She was severely persecuted as she began her career as a labor lawyer and eventually had to flee the country, arriving in Canada in 1996 as a UN-recognized refugee. She is currently under threat of deportation because of her political history in Colombia and Latin America. We'll also hear from Amparo's partner, Dieter Misgel, who originally from Germany is a retired professor from the University of Toronto. He has done a great deal of work on Latin America. We'll also hear from Chater Saini Singh, who is the vice president of the Centre Communautaire des Punjabis du Québec. And I believe the first person who we'll see in the video is Sevantan Sevaraman, who is active for human rights, having arrived in Montreal as a Tamil refugee from northern Sri Lanka. Sivaraman is the co-owner of the property that hosted a community center for Tamils in Montreal until it was closed down by the RCMP in 2008 on suspicions of links to the LTTE, the Tamil Tigers. Since that date, Sivaraman has been involved in costly legal proceedings to regain access to the property. And is he here? Okay, so he'll be here to answer questions after the video.
lectures was this as a mechanism of social and political control, end part one.
Diane, if you want to come forward, if people have questions for you.
Coming up. Two of the panel discussion on the use of terrorism, the mechanism of social and political control.
We're running a little behind. We'll take about 10 or 15 minutes worth of questions. But before that, I just wanted to say thank you to Jadis. I don't know if she's still here, who edited the video for us, and Laura and David, who did all the subtitles. It was hours and hours of work, and it was much appreciated. And also a special thank you to the people who participated in the video and to Issam. It takes a great deal of courage to speak out about these kinds of things, and as you all know, there is a workshop taking place this afternoon where we're going to be talking about strategies for developing a campaign against terrorist lists and terrorist listings in Canada. So if you have thoughts or ideas and comments, please save them for this afternoon. And if for the next few minutes we could limit ourselves to short questions for the panelists or the people who were interviewed in the video. Yeah, and we'll take questions from the mic there, sorry. So if you have a question, you can line up there.
Hello. Je m'appelle Alex Cornel. Je voulais poser une question au panéliste qui a parlé de la liste des terroristes ou la liste noire. D'après vous, comment solutionner ce problème et pourquoi Al-Qaïda, l'Hezbollah, le Front Farundo Marti n'a pas pu réagir contre ces autorités, tu vois, qui posent des problèmes et aux soi-disant terroristes sans avoir des preuves valables? Quelle est la position aussi des pays socialistes et des pays comme l'Iran, tu vois, contre cette audite noire?
Je vais répondre aussi en réagissant à un commentaire d'Issam dans la présentation qui a dit qu'il devrait y avoir une définition beaucoup plus restrictive du terrorisme et qu'on doit faire la distinction entre les mouvements de libération nationale et le terrorisme. Je pense que c'est un peu ça aussi le sens de la question. Ça, c'est des questions d'ordre politique. Les mouvements de libération pour un pays vont être considérés comme quelque chose d'hostile pour un autre pays. Ici, là, je vais exprimer la position de la Ligue. Par rapport à la loi antiterroriste, la loi antiterroriste est inutile et dangereuse. Elle porte atteinte aux droits et elle devrait être abrogée. Donc, il ne devrait pas y avoir de loi antiterroriste et donc de définition du terrorisme dans le code criminel canadien. Ce que les gens entendent par terroriste, c'est-à-dire poser des gestes qui portent atteinte physiquement, qui tuent des personnes, surtout encore plus en grand nombre, sont déjà des infractions au code criminel. Le code criminel a déjà des provisions pour les actes criminels, le complot pour commettre des actes criminels, le trafic d'armes et des choses comme ça. Et il a été très, très bien démontré, entre autres par le barreau canadien, lors de la révision de la loi antiterroriste, que la loi antiterroriste, les gestes terroristes pouvaient très bien être réprimés par une action policière en vertu du code criminel. Donc, nous demandons, et c'est ce que demandent les organisations de défense des droits au Canada, c'est le retrait de la loi antiterroriste et donc de la définition. Pour ce qui est de la lutte contre les listes, ben, c'est évidemment un problème à l'échelle internationale. Et le problème avec ces listes-là, c'est qu'elles sont transnationales. Autrement dit, les Canadiens sont sujets, avec la complicité de leur gouvernement qui plie devant les exigences américaines, mais en fait qui est d'accord avec, soumettent les Canadiens à des listes qui sont imposées par les États-Unis. par exemple, sur la question du voyage, de l'interdiction de vol, le Secure Flight dont je parlais tantôt, notre position, c'est la position qu'on a défendue devant les partis politiques en commission parlementaire, c'est que le Canada devrait se poser le problème à l'Organisation de la civile internationale et s'opposer à des mesures de ce genre en allant cherchant des alliances en Europe où il y a aussi une forte opposition à ces mesures-là. Alors, en fait, c'est une question politique de retirer ces mesures qui, en fin de compte, servent à, comme c'était très bien expliqué dans la vidéo, je ne reviendrai pas là-dessus, là, à, par extension, à criminaliser politiquement des mouvements et donc sont instrumentalisés pour par les gouvernements pour autre chose que lutter contre le terrorisme comme tel.
Hi, my name is Simon Leem. I'm a writer with the Link, the student paper at Concordia. I had two questions for Dominique Béchard. I was just wondering, how many times has the Canada's Anti-Terrorism Act been used, and in what way is it more of a threat, or is it actual, or is it being used quite often? And also for Issam, I was just wondering what your current status in Canada is at this particular moment.
Bon, pour nous, bon, premièrement, la loi antiterroriste a été utilisée pour lister des entités, comme je l'ai déjà mentionné, avec toutes les conséquences que ça entraîne pour les gens qui peuvent par la suite être associés à ces entités-là. D'autres mesures ont été prises en dehors du cadre de la loi antiterroriste, comme la liste d'interdiction de vol canadienne, par exemple, a été adoptée par voie de réglementation. Ça n'a même pas été fait l'objet d'un débat démocratique ou d'une loi au Parlement. D'ailleurs, on peut même contester la légalité, à part le fait que ça viole des droits. Par contre, la loi antiterroriste est une épée de Damoclès. On a vu en 1970 au Canada comment la loi des mesures de guerre a été utilisée dans un contexte québécois. La loi antiterroriste a un grand potentiel de criminaliser et d'intimider, comme il a été démontré. Entre autres, il y avait des provisions dans la loi antiterroriste qui ont été abrogées, mais que les conservateurs veulent réintroduire. Les audiences d'investigation et l'engagement assorti de conditions qui peuvent obliger des personnes à venir témoigner devant un juge, même si elles ne sont pas accusées, ou de les traiter comme des personnes dangereuses et de leur imposer des conditions. Ces deux clauses ont été abrogées. Les conservateurs veulent les réintroduire. Elles sont très dangereuses, entre autres parce qu'elles peuvent être utilisées pour intimider des personnes, comme on l'a vu, comme le CRS le fait, en menaçant de traîner quelqu'un devant un juge pour l'obliger à témoigner. C'est comme l'incriminer publiquement au terrorisme avec toutes les conséquences que ça entraîne. Donc, il y a eu un certain nombre de procès au Canada en vertu de la loi antiterroriste. Il y a eu les 18, entre autres, à Toronto. Bon, un certain nombre ont été... au bout du compte, les accusations sont tombées pour un certain nombre de personnes. Il y a eu une personne au Québec. Il y a eu le cas de Momen Khawaja. Donc, il y a eu un certain nombre de personnes qui ont été poursuivies au Canada en vertu de la loi antiterroriste. Mais en réalité, il n'y avait pas besoin de la loi antiterroriste pour les poursuivre. Les gestes posés auraient pu être incriminés en vertu du code criminel.
Yes, under deportation order, the immigration or the Canadian border and services are not enforcing it. They are waiting for me to leave voluntarily, and I'm waiting for them to enforce it.
En fait, c'est un peu ce que vous dites quand vous dites qu'il aurait pu le faire de toute façon avec le code criminel. Alors que le Canada et les États-Unis sont probablement les plus grands assassins et meurtriers dans le monde, puis ils ne s'accuseront jamais en termes cellules parce que c'est eux qui font les lois. Je veux dire, les lois sont là pour nous maintenir dans la répression aussi. Enfin,
le problème avec, par exemple, des choses comme les certificats de sécurité, c'est que les personnes sont... des mesures sont prises contre des personnes à partir de preuves, entre guillemets, preuves, là, dont ils n'ont pas connaissance, donc contre lesquelles ils ne peuvent pas se défendre dans un procès. Nous, ce qu'on dit, c'est que le droit criminel doit être appliqué. Le droit criminel, c'est que quelqu'un doit avoir posé des gestes qui sont des crimes, c'est-à-dire d'aller comploter pour tuer ou blesser des personnes. Ce qui est un crime et ce que nous condamnons en tant qu'organisation de défense de droit. Mais dans le code criminel, il faut que la police ramasse des preuves convaincantes, qu'elle porte ses accusations devant une cour. L'accusé a droit de connaître toute la preuve contre lui. Il a le droit de se défendre. Donc, on maintient que les personnes qui sont, pour lutter contre le terrorisme, on doit utiliser les mêmes méthodes que l'on utilise pour lutter, par exemple, contre la mafia. La mafia, les mafiosos, ils ont droit, un avocat, ils ont droit de connaître les accusations, ils ont droit de connaître la preuve. Alors, on maintient que le code criminel est déjà un outil satisfaisant pour lutter contre ce que les gens entendent normalement par un acte terroriste.
OK, ça c'est la position de la Ligue, mais moi j'aimerais ça savoir ce que les autres qui sont eux-mêmes victimes de ces mesures-là en pensent.
Well, actually, I was affected, I think, anti-terror law last time. It was 2002, right? The anti-terror law became effect. But, you know, in my case, actually, I had a long time affected by this because, you know, in 1994, I was accused by CIS as being a member of the PKK. That time, there was no anti-terror, I don't believe that. You know, even there was a... they didn't even put PKK on the terrorist list, but still, you know, they oppressed me to work to spy on my fellow Kurds and on the community, and then they started targeting me. Like since 1994 up to now, actually, as I said, you know, during my interview, intimidation, threats, blackmailing. It all became part of my life, actually. It's still going on. My struggle goes on too, of course. That's all I can say about anti-terror.
I think the effects depends on how do we perceive the whole issue. For me personally, I think whatever is happening with me is part of the package, part of when we commit ourselves to the struggle, we expect more than being deported or being questioned by CISIS or any other organization. Of course, it has social effect, like many people, they became very careful of calling you over the phone or visiting you. But I think what CISIS and the security apparatus wanted is to break us, and we shouldn't be broken. Thanks.
If I am talking about my community, the anti-terrorism law put LTTE on terrorist list. With that, they actually broke the spirit of my people in Canada. Right now, they are leaderless. They don't know what to do. They are scared of everything, and they don't trust anybody anymore. Because we ran from a government oppression from my country, I ran from it, and the government used the criminals to, how do you call, terrorize the Tamils. They actually opened up prisons and gave them guns and go shoot Tamils. Here, the government of Canada using Tamil criminal elements against Tamils themselves and demoralizing Tamils right now. And we cannot trust even our people. It became to a point that we cannot trust anybody we see or talk. Okay? That's the situation we are in right now.
Question for the people who, what kind of strategies, because so much talking that sort of to reverse the attempts to sort of to break the will of communities to voice their, I mean, to express their views, to actually to defend their rights, whether it be in terms of here or their own struggles back home. What strategies as individuals or as communities attempt to sort of to break that, to reverse that, because it is part of a larger struggle?
I do understand your question, but I will say I do not have an answer for it, because Canada said when the LTT threat is gone, we will find solution for the Tamils, we will find the rights of Tamils. Right now, Tamils are being killed hundreds of thousands by the day, every day. There's 1.8 million Tamils dead for the past 30 years. But even here, the media only says that there's 100,000 dead, there's 68,000 dead. This is what they're talking, okay? According to Oxford University statistics, there's 1.8 million Tamils dead in the past 30 years. And they are being killed still right now, okay? And the Canada doesn't say a word what's going on, what are you going to do, what is the future for Tamils. They don't even ask that question, because for them, they want an ally in Indian Ocean probably. Sri Lanka is a very well-suited place for their trade and everything. And until they have that ally, they don't care what that ally doing to their own people.
Depends also about, like, in our case, the Palestinian case. I don't think that factional politics is important for Palestinians in Canada. To have, like, a branch for the PFLP, it's useless, or to have a branch for Fatah in Canada. What is the strategy in this case that Palestinian activists should concentrate and really working with Canadian unions, churches, Canadian solidarity movement, and keep the struggle goes on. That's the best strategy. It's very legitimate, and it's it gains support, and it has a momentum in Canada.
You know, in this case, like persons. Kurdish community is kind of as a result of CISA's efforts, it became marginalized. I mean, I believe there are many communities in this position, as my friend said, you know, Tamil community in the same position. In order to break, you know, their aim is to, through the fear atmosphere and breaking up, breaking, you know, the spirit and unity and strength of the community, they are, they achieve that actually to some extent. In order to overcome this, you know, I think communities, first of all, need to mobilize themselves and to, and this is cannot be done on the, they cannot done on their own. They need to outreach other communities who have the similar problems, and to mobilize, and also the progressive voices, you know, in this country to kind of, you know, a nationwide, I think, campaign. It's very, I think it's, I mean, the oppressed people in this country, I called oppressed people by CISAS, I mean, communities or marginalized communities should join their forces, actually. You cannot kind of fight against this kind of state apparatus or monster, have everything, high technology and everything. You know, it's and also they have informers, they already created divisions within the community. You cannot achieve or overcome this kind of fear atmosphere. And also, as I said, you know, we need to mobilize actually at the you know, national wide actually.
All of you, it appears, would have paid considerable cost for being community leaders in your own communities. I would like to know what immediate future you see in terms of risk to yourself. Would you be? Is it likely that you might be arrested or deported or whatever, as you see? If you have any indication of your personal fears about yourself.
If I was to be deported, I will continue my struggle in Lebanon or wherever I go.
No, their aim is to create fear, as I said, also to scare us. If you buy their tactics, then you are dead. You know, they already achieved, means that they have achieved their goals, right? I mean, we cannot, but we need to stand up. We need to resist. If we don't do that, we are dead. As I said during the interview, it's true that, you know, then they achieve their goals. You cannot live with the fear. I mean, if I was scared, like at the beginning when they threatened me at the result of 8 hours interrogation. So I just, as other friends, for instance, who were in the same situation, limbo situation, they just isolated themselves from the community, and we never heard from them. Some friends we never heard. They want us to be in this position. No, we cannot be doing it. We cannot be threatened or intimidated by kind of fear or, be arrested, If you are community leaders, if you are voice of our people, we have to stand up. Even there is a risk of being arrested or being jailed. For what? We believe in our cause. We have cause,
For me, all these security agencies, I consider them as a bargainer, because when FBI, they came to Sudan and interrogated me there, they bargaining with me. I ignore them, and now I'm ignoring them. And for me, them are the bargainer. They bargain for very, very cheap cost. Because of their very cheap cause, I will ignore them. And I will stand up with different groups and people to smash their cause. And I will do.
There's a better way to end, so we'll call it there. There have just been some room changes. We have two workshops this afternoon. The Media Fight Back Immigration Security Measures workshop is going to be happening in this room in about 20, 25 minutes. And then the blacklisting workshop to develop a strategy for a campaign against the terrorist list is going to be happening in room H763, which is immediately that way. Thank you so much to all of our panelists.
And panel discussion on terrorist lists as a mechanism of social and political control.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.